maid service. My daughters. I'd like to bring the House Committee on General Government Consumer Protection into order. Good morning, committee members and members of the public. We have an agenda today. I think we're just going to march down in the order that the agenda is posted on. And so with that, I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 11. Jan, could you give us a description of Senate Bill 11?
Mr. Chair and committee members, the bill stipulates that the Deputy State Treasurer may, in the event of a vacancy, exercise the duties of the State Treasurer. Specifies that the Deputy State Treasurer maintains duties assigned by the former State Treasurer until modified by the subsequent State Treasurer. And it changes the title of Chief Deputy State Treasurer to the Deputy State Treasurer. Declares an emergency effective on passage. No amendments before you, no fiscal impact, and no revenue impact.
And do we have somebody here signed up to talk to us about Senate Bill 11? Michael Burdick.
Yeah.
Good morning. Welcome to the committee. And if you would identify yourself for the record, please.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Michael Burdick, and I'm with the State Treasurer's Office. I'm legislative assistant. I'm here to speak in support of Senate Bill 11. Senate Bill 11, of course, addresses the unexpected vacancy in the office of the State Treasurer. It comes to you from the Senate where it passed 30-0. As you know, our state experienced an unexpected vacancy in the office of the State Treasurer last year when State Treasurer Ben Westland passed away while in office. And at the time, the State Treasury was in the middle of a large bond sale as well as a number of other important business functions. Although Treasurer Westland had delegated signatory authority over much of that business to the Deputy State Treasurer, statutes left the vital question unanswered as to whether, in the absence of a State Treasurer, those duties that had been delegated to the Deputy were retained by the Deputy. The Department of Justice did affirm that the Deputy retained duties that had been delegated by the Treasurer until a new Treasurer is appointed and changes those duties. The Department of Justice suggested that this be codified in statute, and so Senate Bill 11 makes that statutory change. The state constitution and statutes are clear in providing that the governor will appoint a replacement to the treasurer, but that generally takes a few days for the appointment to go through, and statutes don't speak to what happens in the meantime. So Senate Bill 11 prevents disruption to the vital business operations of the state treasury in the event of a vacancy. There's also, as Ms. Norland pointed out, two unsubstantial changes in the bill. Simply changing the title of the deputy from Chief Deputy State Treasurer to Deputy Treasurer, since there is only one Deputy Treasurer. And the second small change is that it clarifies that personnel in the State Treasury are not necessarily all clerks and stenographers. These are just changes to modernize the statutes. The Treasurer's Office asks for your aye vote on Senate Bill 11.
Thank you. I appreciate that overview from the Treasurer's Office. Any questions from the committee? Representative Clem.
Just two questions. Who's currently occupying the position that we're changing the name of?
Mr. Chair, Representative Clem, the Deputy Treasurer currently is Darren Bond.
So were you all operating outside the law by not being clerks and stenographers all these years only?
It's my Mr. Chair, Representative Clem, it's my understanding that is not the case, that this is not a substantial change in law.
Glad we cleared that up. Thank you.
Representative Smith.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. So to me, sort of the crux of the matter is, you know, should we transfer all the duties other than the constitutional duties, all the duties other than sitting on the land board, from the treasurer to a deputy treasurer in the event that the treasurer becomes incapacitated? And then, therefore, as we get to the meat of it, it's, are there duties that deputy treasurer would perform that we would feel less comfortable about a non-elected person fulfilling. Not that there's anything magical about it, but maybe it would be important. The question I'd have for you, and I don't know if there's anybody else who's going to testify on this, is as we look at that sort of bucket of duties, are there that seem, do we need to treat them all alike, or are there any that might not need to be delegated? And in particular, are there kinds of, as it occurred to me yesterday and last night, it seems like there's two kinds of decisions that might make us a little more nervous. One would be really, really big decisions. Right? Those would say, well, those are the kind of things why we have a constitutional elected treasurer. And the second might be the decisions that it'd keep. It's like, well, yeah, we can let somebody make this decision, but why not just wait until we have the new treasurer? And particularly if there are any decisions that were kind of big and could keep, those would be the things that would seem really likely we'd want to hold on to until the next treasurer. And I don't know enough about, I've reviewed, I've read the budget for a couple of sessions now, but I don't know chapter and verse on the treasurer's duties to understand what might be in those things. But as I said to Silvaggio yesterday, and as I would say to you today, I at least would be interested at a relatively disciplined look at are there duties that would make sense to either, somewhere between nothing different from now to everything other than land board, wondering if there's any space in between that we might empower the deputy treasurer to do.
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, just to be clear, and I think that this is your understanding too, what you just expressed, is that this confers all statutory duties of the state treasurer onto the deputy treasurer in these few days of vacancy. It doesn't speak to any constitutional duties.
Yeah.
So we did consider whether some statutory duties ought to be conferred and not others. And we feel that all statutory duties should be conferred on the deputy treasurer.
How do you feel about that?
There's no way to anticipate what business might be going on when this unexpected event occurs. Obviously, we're planning for an unanticipated contingency, and there's really no way to anticipate what sorts of powers the deputy might need to be able to exercise in those few days. Again, it is only a few days likely that the deputy would hold these powers, and the governor would always be able to make an appointment in order to provide for a new treasurer to make the decisions. Let's see. Also, the deputy treasurer was selected and trusted by the previous treasurer, so we feel he would be competent to carry out these decisions. And again, this is just preparing for an unexpected contingency we hope would never occur. We feel that for this small period of days, it's appropriate to allow the deputy treasurer to prevent disruption to state business.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Follow up.
I got at least two questions. One, what's the longest period of time it could be?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, my understanding is that the governor is able to appoint on his own schedule.
That's not my question. Is there a statutory maximum a period of time? Is there any time? Is there any time within which the governor must make the appointment? What's the longest period of time this could be?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, I would have to check the statutes, but my conceivably it could be until the next general election if the governor chose not to act.
Okay, so that'd be my hunch too. My second question is, do we have a delineated list of the statutory duties? And if we don't, could we get one? Because I understand your view, you guys wrote the bill, right, that it would be, we think they should all go. I get that. It's a legitimate view. I don't know if I have that view yet.
Mm-hmm.
So what would be helpful to me is to see a list of the statutory duties and to, get a gauge of should it be all of them or should it be some of them? And would love anybody who wanted to offer input on that question would be, it'd be really valuable. I don't have a particular axe to grind, but it does seem to me to be the crux of the matter.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, we'd be happy to provide you with the list.
Thanks, ma'am.
Any other questions? Comments? Mr. Burdick, thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, may I say one more thing?
You bet.
We did a little bit of research talking to some other states in case the committee would be interested to know that Washington and California both allow the deputy treasurer to have all statutory authority until a new treasurer is appointed. Washington actually doesn't provide for the governor's appointment of a new treasurer, but allows the deputy to retain those duties until the next general election.
Thank you. It certainly seems to make sense that we have a treasurer that is separately elected, holds a separate office, and you would want that separate office to be able to continue and make the decisions of that office and not be delegated somewhere else. I agree with that. Thank you, Mr. Burdick. I appreciate you testifying and answering a few questions. And there is some follow-up, I assume that Representative Smith would like to see. So,
thank you.
That would be great. Thank you. With that, I'm going to, no one else wishing to testify on Senate Bill 11, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 11. Stand at ease for a minute.
Representative
Wisnett, you have a motion for me on Senate Bill 11?
When I find my place. Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 11 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Wisnett moves Senate Bill 11 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? I'll just make a few comments. I know there's been some questions and some follow-up that we'd like to have on a list of those duties and perhaps some information about what other states also do this, but I think the chairs are comfortable moving this forward at this point. And certainly if something comes up, there's an ability for someone to make a motion on the floor. Having said that, any other discussion? Seeing none, Tamara, could we have a roll call vote, please? Excused.
Representative Plum.
Aye.
Representative Conger.
Aye.
Representative Matthews.
Aye.
Vice Chair Sheehan.
Yes.
Vice Chair Smith.
Aye.
Co-Chair Wissett.
Aye.
Co-Chair Holby.
Aye. Senate Bill 11, having received the required votes, is passed to the floor. And volunteer to carry the bill.
Representative Smith wants to.
He seems to know more
deeply
about it.
That's true.
I'm okay.
So, you can't
Representative Conger, thanks.
Be happy to do it.
With that, I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 11. Open a public hearing on. Next on my agenda list is 177. Jan, can you give us a brief description of Senate Bill 177?
brief. Mr. Chairs and committee members, it reduces the required frequency of meetings of credit union boards of directors from monthly to 10 times per calendar year in separate months. It allows a credit union to appoint a chief credit officer in lieu of a credit committee. Permits credit unions to make loans under certain conditions to the president or chief executive officer of the credit union or to officers who have policymaking or credit approval authority. Specifies how credit unions may invest funds not used in loans to members. Allows credit unions chartered under Oregon law to merge with credit unions chartered under laws of another state in the same manner as mergers occur between two credit unions chartered in Oregon. Establishes procedure for credit union members opposed to a merger proposal to provide information to fellow members regarding their views about the merger proposal. There are no amendments before you. There's no revenue impact and no fiscal impact.
Thank you. And we have before us Pam Levitt and Al Scoggins and Scott Burgess.
Thank you.
And Kevin Cole.
Good morning, Co-Chairs Holvey and Wisnett, members of the committee. I'm Pam Levitt, representing the Northwest Credit Union Association. You have extensive testimony from all of us, and we will not go through it all. There's some very good information, but we will each summarize some points of the bill. Senate Bill 177 is what we do every 2 years in credit unions. We go through the Oregon Credit Union Act and work with our membership to look for updates and changes. The financial services industry, as you know, changes regularly, and how we serve our members and the kinds of powers that we need does change regularly. Before we go through the bill, I just want to make a few comments about your Oregon credit unions. There are 82 state and federally chartered credit unions in Oregon. 40% of Oregonians belong to a credit union. We're $1.4 billion in assets. As you all know, we're not-for-profit financial cooperatives, and that structure has served us well during this economic crisis over the last few years as Oregon credit unions have stayed strong and continued to serve their members. We do pay a number of taxes, but as not-for-profits, we are income tax exempt, and Congress reaffirmed that structure in 1998. We're owned by our members, one member, one vote, with volunteer boards of directors, and we still have membership eligibility requirements. That's kind of a basic snapshot of credit unions. I'm going to have Hal Scoggins go through the sections of the bill. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Holvey, Chair Wisnett. My name is, and members of the committee, my name is Hal Scoggins. I'm an attorney with Farley, Wada, and Witt in Portland, and we represent the Northwest Credit Union Association, as well as most of the credit unions throughout Oregon, Washington, and many in the Pacific Northwest and beyond. We've worked with the association and the credit unions that are members of the association in crafting this bill that's before you now, and I'll hit the high points and then be happy to answer any questions. There are five basic things that this bill does, all of them are relatively technical and fairly straightforward, non-controversial in the credit union community. And the first is it makes a change to the requirement for board meetings. The current statute requires the board of a credit union to meet monthly except during the month when they have an annual meeting. And what we found, especially over the last year in times when there's been inclement weather that might force a board to want to postpone a meeting in a month, that if we make this change to requiring boards to meet 10 times a year instead of each month, then if they are in a situation where they're at the end of a particular month, their meeting might be in the last week of a particular month in the winter, and they have to postpone it, they don't violate the statute simply by postponing the meeting from one calendar month into the next calendar month. So that's what the first change is all about, is simply to allow more flexibility for boards in terms of how they structure their meetings. Mm-hmm. Second is a very controversial change, changing the title of credit manager to chief credit officer, and that is simply one that most of our credit unions have have gone with the title of Chief Credit Officer for a number of years, and it's more in keeping with the statute to have the statute updated to reflect current practice so that there's no question in terms of the members' minds, anyone else's minds, you know, who's serving what function. So we're simply changing credit manager to Chief Credit Officer. The third is one where it relates to loans that are made to senior management and directors and other volunteers, supervisory committee members, and those loans currently require approval of the board before they can be made. Once anyone's loan, any of those senior management and board members' loans in the aggregate reach $100,000, any loan that would cause their aggregate to exceed that amount would then have to be approved by the board. And what this has the effect of doing is any time that a board or senior manager gets a mortgage loan, then, you know, even a $2,000 credit card account after that requires board approval, or a, you know, $25,000 car loan requires board approval. And that wasn't really the intent of the requirements. And so what this change would do is to knock mortgage loans out of that approval requirement and say any loan other than a mortgage loan that is under the conforming limit, the limit for Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac conforming loans, that would not be subject to board approval, and the limit, the $100,000 limit, would apply to all other types of loans. And the reason for that is that mortgage loans are so heavily regulated and subject to scrutiny in terms of the appraisal requirements, the approval requirements, secondary market standards that most credit unions want their loans to meet. Even if they're maintaining the loan on their books, they want that loan to meet secondary market standards for both regulatory reasons and flexibility. There's so much scrutiny that's built into that process already that we feel like it's really not necessary to have the added layer of a board approval requirement there. And so this would permit credit unions to streamline that process and take first mortgage loans that are conforming loans out of the process that requires board approval. Fourth thing that the bill does is it increases the limit for credit unions to invest in what's called a CUSO, a credit union service organization. This is a subsidiary organization that is formed by a credit union for the purpose of maybe providing services to members like insurance or brokerage services, or it might be formed for performing services for the credit union or for a group of credit unions such as data processing or check processing or other sort of back office operations. And credit unions are finding more and more in today's marketplace that it is necessary to take advantage of economies of scale and collaborate with other credit unions and form a service organization that maybe performs these functions for a number of credit unions, and the credit unions are able to realize a cost savings by essentially keeping those services in-house in an organization that's owned by the credit unions. But In doing it for a number of credit unions, they're able to realize economies of scale. The current limit for investment in a credit union service organization for credit unions is 2% of their assets. And what we want to change that is to be 5% of assets so that credit unions, again, would be able to invest a little bit more money in these organizations that are providing both back office services and services for members as well. Then the last thing that the bill would do is it makes some changes in the process for a credit union to approve a merger with another credit union. Because credit unions are owned by their members, the members have to approve any merger of a credit union into another credit union. And the current wording of the statute left some ambiguity as to whether members actually had to show up in person and vote at a meeting. And so one of the things that this bill would do is change it to make it clearer that electronic or mail balloting is permitted in addition to actually showing up in person at the meeting. This allows for maximum participation by all the members in the credit union and not just those who are able and willing to show up at the meeting. The other thing that it would do is, again, make a sort of a minor clarification in the statutory wording to make it clear that a merger with an out-of-state credit union is to be considered by the regulator on the same grounds and same standards as a merger with an in-state credit union. There were some people who felt there was a bit of ambiguity there that needed to be cleared up. And then finally, the last thing that it does is it provides a process for members who want to express a dissenting voice to the merger to other members of the credit union. It provides a process for them to do that. If the credit union operates a blog or some other website or forum where members can post comments or do things like that, then a member who wants to dissent from the merger can make a posting there. Or if the credit union is disseminating information via mail instead of using that other form, then the member may have to pay for it, but they will be able to get their dissenting voice into the materials that are going out to the other membership. So again, it's all really about making things more democratic and allowing maximum participation in the merger process. That is a very quick overview of the bill's key features, and I would be happy to take any questions at this point.
Is there any other testimony that you want to give on this bill, any of the others, or are you just there for support?
Bodyguards.
We can answer any questions.
Thank you. I think I will call you back up in a few minutes, but I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 177, and we'll reopen it in a few minutes. I want to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 440. Jan, can you give us a description of Senate Bill 440?
It allows state boards and commissions to meet by telephone or other electronic means. It clarifies members who participate by phone or other electronic means are not entitled to compensation or reimbursement for their expenses. It provides discretion to give per diem to non-elected members of boards and commissions not employed in full-time public service who participate in official duties by telephone or other electronic means. Establishes requirement that the State Plumbing Board, Electrical and Elevator Board, the Board of Boiler Rules meet at least four times in a year.
Skype.
Establishes requirements of the Building Code Structure Board, Residential Manufactured Structure Board, the Mechanical Board, and the Construction Industry Energy Board, non-licensing boards, meet at least twice a year. Deletes three commissions that no longer function. Those are the Pacific Fisheries Legislative Task Force, the Columbia River Resource Task Force, and the Healthy Streams Partnership. There are no amendments before you today. There's no revenue impact, and there is a fiscal statement issued.
Thank you. And we have Ryan Mann signed up, and I don't know if he has anyone else he wants to bring up with him.
Somebody, maybe.
Senator Courtney. Good morning and welcome to our committee, your committee, and if you'd identify yourself for the record, please.
Chair Olvey and Chair Wissanami and members of the Federal Government and Consumer Protection Committee of the Oregon House of Representatives. My name is Peter Courtney. I'm a state senator, District 11, which includes major portions of Salem. And goes up, takes in Jervis and Woodburn. I'm here to testify in support of the Senate Bill 440. This bill was a bill that came out of my office last session, and it passed the Senate, and there was no problems with it, and then it went to the House, which had a little amendment, which immediately got in trouble with the governor, who vetoed the bill. So the bill is back again, and it was a product of Sasha Pollock, my office, who worked very hard in the governor's office to deal with certain boards and commissions to clean up some vagueness and some ambiguities. And basically what the bill does is it allows boards and commissions to meet by phone or electronic device. Individuals can call in to participate. It clarifies that, including legislators. But if a legislator who's on a board or commission chooses to participate that way, they do not get per diem. They will not get per diem. That's what's clarified in there. That's one of the major clarifications. So that ambiguity is cleared up. The next one is, if for 15 boards and commissions, and again, I don't know every detail of this bill, but there are 15 boards and commissions out there that are currently silent on per diem when it comes to telling about how they should get per diem or not. And this specifies guidelines for the 15 boards and commissions. So that is also laid out there. Then it also modifies meeting requirements for 7 specialty code boards that assist DCBS. Now, this is an addition to the bill that came off the Senate floor. DCBS weighed in this time for a very good reason. And they added an amendment which we supported in the Senate Rules Committee, where it came out unanimously, and off the Senate floor, where it came off unanimously. And what that does is, right now, the boards that assist DCBS sometimes meet simply to comply with statute, even though they have no work to do. They're required to meet so often, they have no work to do, so they got to bring everybody in. That changes. The statute says that DCBS licensing boards need to meet 4 times a year, and non-licensing boards need to meet only twice a year. This is a DCBS amendment. They're supportive. Again, they feel that basically that allows them to meet when they need to meet and not come in to meet when they don't need to meet. So I'm being very specific, general, to the general government here in the House of Representatives. But that's all this basically does. It's a housekeeping measure bill that I think we do need. It was very favorably considered by the Senate last session. The House, too, but that little amendment got in there, and that's when the governor said, we're not doing this. So that amendment's not in there, and I hope that you will, a group of individuals, consider this bill. You decide whether you like it or not, do what you want. But I'm sort of hoping, even though we have a new governor, that you don't try that amendment again. So I have no idea whether this new governor likes it or not, but the amendment was put in over my objection. I was not happy about it. We don't need to belabor the amendment, but I just wanted to give you the history of the bill. And again, you have, I think, my written written testimony. I don't like to read from my written testimony, so that's why I tried to speak in a general way to you. Ryan Mann's here with me, who has worked very hard, Mom. He's my newest hire from Oregon State. I had to hire him because they got so many beaver ducks running around up there. And I got a Sooner on the Husky running around. This is just not right. This is not right. It's an unnatural act. So I went out and got me a good beaver, former president of the student body. His wife is the, so I'm feeling very good about life because I got, it only takes one beaver to take care of what, two ducks. So I'm all happy about that. That's going to get me a lot of trouble with everybody, but that's all right. So, but Ryan has worked diligently on the bill, knows the details, and he's my Sasha. Well, I shouldn't say that. Sasha. Well, I shouldn't say that because he's got to be himself. You understand what I'm saying? So, but he's here to help with any detailed questions that you may have that I can't answer. And I do appreciate, I didn't mean for you, Chair Holden, to shut down the other committee. I didn't ask for that, so I feel embarrassed that you shut down the other bill you're working on. I assume because I was here, so I feel bad. So, anyway, that's what the bill does. I felt I should come down and testify on it and talk to you about it because, well, it's a... They haven't heard a word I've said?
Start over. As usual, really bad.
So I appreciate that, oh great, committee administrator. So that's about all I have to say at this time until you either hit me with questions, comments, or severe criticisms. Honor and privilege to be here, really is. So.
Yeah, well, thank you, Senator Courtney. I appreciate you coming in. I don't think that... I made an amendment to your bill in the previous session. Maybe Representative Harvey did.
No, but, it was Representative Roblin.
Oh.
Now first speaker. And he knows about it. He knows how I feel about it. So I have to be very frank with you, Chair. That's who did it. It's a culprit.
Yeah, and I know you didn't ask to have me interrupt at other meeting, but I felt that we would probably have some longer discussions, and I know you're a busy person, and I felt that everybody that was here for that previous bill would enjoy hearing you talk about this one. So that was sort of the chair's prerogative there. I appreciate you bringing this bill forward again. I think it's a good bill. I see if we have any questions for you from the committee.
I have one question.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. President, for bringing this over. And maybe Ryan might be better to answer. I gave a presentation at PSU recently, and I was had a student there from listening in by Skype from Germany. Would this bill allow commissions to, you know, says electronic means, would that cover that?
Chair, let me try. Even though you haven't directed a question at me, then Ryan can do it. Chair Holby, Chair, wasn't it, and members of the General Government Committee. I think it would. And unless, if I'm wrong, Ryan, you better say something. But in terms of making a record, I believe it would fit within electronic device.
Thank you, sir.
So, not seeing any other. Oh, Representative Clem.
I don't know if you can see me way down here.
Representative
Lynn. Hey, Mr. Chair. I used to sit a little closer, but I was misbehaving, Mr. President. So
he's a beaver, too.
And I may or may not be student body president.
Any
yeah.
Now,
oh,
go ahead.
Oh, thank you. Now, lines 13 through 15, it says a state board or commission may compensate or reimburse a member who attends a meeting, which clearly leaves it at the discretion of the board or commission. Was it the case before that they were in the habit of doing it or not doing it? Because I used to participate in the Historic Preservation Commission by phone routinely because I had an infant child and I didn't want her squalling in person at the meeting. And I assumed I could not be compensated, didn't want to be, but that topic just really never came up. So was the past standard unclear, and should we be saying that they really shouldn't be, period? This obviously makes it possible to. I just assumed since I wasn't driving there, I wasn't incurring any expenses, I shouldn't be reimbursed. And I'm wondering what the past standard was that we're now either clarifying or changing.
Chair Wisnant, Representative Clem. This is a good question. And
if you could introduce yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry. Ryan Mann, I'm a policy analyst in the Office of the Senate President. Thanks for having me here today. Representative Clem, I think this is a good question. President Courtney raised it as we were talking about this bill. This may be too much information, but just quickly go through. I think what this does is says any public official participating by phone would not be eligible for per diem under this bill. And in terms of other folks participating by phone on a board or commission, my understanding of what this language does is says that it leaves it to the specific board or commission, and the existing per diem guidelines would apply whether they're participating by phone or not. I'm not sure if that addresses your question or not.
Chair Holby, Chair, wasn't it, Representative Clinton? I has to understand the issue of electronic communication, specifically in terms of per diem, applies to any legislator. If you're coming in by any kind of, you do not get per diem. That's the most important thing this bill does. However, if you're not a legislator, I'm simplifying here, you know, a volunteer serves on it, you can participate that way and get per diem, right? I mean, that's the thing that's important. It also allows the legislator to participate electronically, and I don't know whether that was up in the air or not, tell you the truth. But the issue of per diem has been clarified. Legislators have got to be here in person or it doesn't get per diem. Non-legislators can also participate electronically, but their per diem issue is they do get the per diem. So is that pretty much what I'm saying, right? I want to make sure I'm right.
That's correct. Yeah.
That's correct. So that I don't mean to conflict, confuse anything, but sometimes if you don't separate the non-legislator, we're talking non-legislative and legislative, this can get very confusing.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I think Section 1 of the bill addresses that specifically. It says a state board or commission may compensate or reimburse a member who attends a meeting through telephone or other electronic means as provided in ORS 292-495 at the discretion of the board or commission.
The part that confused me is the one right above that, saying a member of a state board or commission who attends a meeting through telephone is not entitled to compensation.
That's notwithstanding 292.85, though. So I think that's our operative word, is we're not changing, as this president is, we're not changing that per diem structure.
Again, Chair Hovey.
I don't want to amend this at all. I just want to pass it. Sorry.
Well, Chair Hovey, Chair Wisenhunt, and Representative Clem, you know, nothing I've ever done has been perfect. You do understand that. The ultimate non-perfect, flawed human being is now before you. So, if you want to take this thing apart and redo it in some way, if that's what your collective wisdom is, then, you know, I don't want to discourage that in any way, shape, or form. I'm not saying, you know what I mean, I don't know what perfection is, I only know what flaw is. So, I defer to your individual and collective wisdoms. Just don't put that amendment back in that bill.
Jesus. Any other discussion? Senator Courtney, I maybe ask you something that's somewhat related to the bill, but not perhaps exactly related to this bill. This committee had some bills earlier this session that we did not end up working that had to do with looking at consolidating boards and commissions around the state, recognizing that we have an awful lot of them, and trying, and some very closely related to each other. And we weren't really able to get a handle on that, and I know the Reset Committee from the last governor's office kind of pointed this direction but never really gave any specifics on what boards and commissions to look at. Do you think that in the future there's a way for the legislature to grapple with that topic, or whether it makes sense for us to look at boards and commissions and see if there's some more efficient way of providing those oversights?
Chair Holvey, Chair Wisenhunt, members of the General Government Consumer Protection Committee of the Great Oregon House of Representatives, yes, there is, absolutely. But you've got to know how to do it. There's one secret to this.
Short answer.
No, you see, you're supposed to say, what is the secret?
Yeah.
That was the signal.
Yeah.
You don't just let me in with this a secret.
Well, I don't know if I want to say. I'm not going to ask you to disclose your secrets in front of.
I'm getting all this on my camera phone, by the way.
There is a, if you really want to be serious about it, yeah, but you have to do it a certain way. And this is 26 years of doing this. I will tell you how you do it. You got to get a rock star, key committee person, key staff person. I had Sasha Pollock. This bill is Sasha Pollock's bill. This isn't the governor's bill. This isn't board. Sasha Pollock, with all due respect, who left me to become chief of staff for some Clackamas County commissioner, and then that commissioner now is gone, the governor, so Sasha thinks in Seattle. But Sasha literally wouldn't let go of it. And if you really want to know how to do this stuff, I think it's in general, you get a staff person in your individual office, whatever, that is very well, you know, they're intelligent. They have some people skills, not too many, because then they take note, and they decide they're going to do it. That is how you work change often in the legislative process. Everybody thinks it's us. I'm sorry, I know you're all great, and you're all great. I'm going to tell you, it comes down to the staff, and you've got to be great. You get a great staff person, you will. They'll keep hammering the governor's office or those commissioners, and they'll come back, and you, et cetera, et cetera, and you will get there. You will make changes. How much, I don't know. But this bill is a result of one individual who happened to be a staff person in my office. It could have been in any senator's office. Could have been in your office. So if you really want to know, that's my humble opinion. I don't think a legislator on his or her own can really get there. I'm sorry, I don't mean to be disrespectful to you or any members of this committee, and I know you're all extraordinarily, you have extraordinary DNA, extraordinary gene pools. But I just got to tell you, it's my experience, when you want to do what you suggest, which has got to be done, it should have been done, must be done, that will be the way you do it.
Thank you for that. I guess, Senator, I was kind of curious, did Sasha get a lot of input and help from the executive branch of government in that endeavor?
Chair Hovey, yes, she did. But she got it because she wouldn't go away. I mean, did you know Sasha?
Oh, yes.
Okay. Sasha wouldn't go away. I'm just going to be very frank. She would not go. I mean, she wasn't obnoxious. You know, come on, I don't want to. That's not fair. I wish she was here. She could talk to you, and so you get a feel. But she would not go away. So she was the catalyst. She was the catalyst. So she got a ton of it. But this bill broke her heart, because when they messed with it in the House, I love the House. I serve in the House. I love the House. But when they messed with it, and then the governor, we're all gone home, dumps it, So that's it. But she got all kinds of input because she just stayed at, you know, stayed the course, stayed on the bridge. No matter how bad the storm was, she never left the helm.
Well, thank you. I just wanted to get an opportunity to ask you that question. It seemed like a good time. Any other questions for the senator?
Chair, how come they glare at me? What's going on with me? They don't love me?
It's admiration, sir.
I'm looking at every single one of you made eye contact, and no, there's no love in these eyes, and I just don't know what's the story here.
Representative Clem, do you have has everybody else spoken?
He's in the doghouse. I don't want somebody in the doghouse making love to me.
No.
I mean, that's true. That's
what? Are we allowed to strike things from the record?
Thank you. Since you're here and you talked about bridges, I wonder if you wanted to comment on the readiness of our 25 bridges during storms compared to the CRC, and which would be a better investment.
Is that germane to the bill?
Probably not. I didn't think I'd get the question out before you gavel
it
down.
Joe, hopefully that may help, Representative Clinton. You say during storms or during an earthquake?
Earthquake / tsunami.
Yeah. Well, truly, you're not going to have to worry about any bridges. You're not going to have any. So that's to say, you better hope it doesn't hit today because they're all going down. I think you all know about size. That's one of my big issues. But truly, it is. We all know how dramatic it would be if it hit today in terms of you better be where you're living because you're not going to be able to get there if you're not unless they get a helicopter or something. But you all know that. In addition, the building's gone. So you better hope you're not in it so we don't know where we're going to be. And you know all this. You don't need to hear from me. That. I'm not being sarcastic. The Columbia River bridge? The bridge should have been built yesterday. In fact, it should have been built a long time ago. It needs to be built right now. I mean, I'm just being telling you, it needs to be built. Now. Is that the answer? You want an answer? That's my answer.
I'm trying to get Rutherford Smith riled up.
Well, I answered your question as best I could, Chair Holman. Would you deal with this? You asked me a question about the Columbia River Bridge in a cute way. The bridge should be built now.
I have no argument with that. I don't think we need a Board of Commission to do that, though. So, with that, I'm going to close the pub. We have more people to testify. Thank you very much, Mr. President, for gracing this committee with your presence and describing Senate Bill 440. Appreciate it. We'll try to keep the amendments down to a minimum. Next up, I have Brian Krieg.
Short. Never know what he's going to say. Fall down.
And Mr. Ryan, did you want to come up too? Just or pass? No, you don't.
No.
Pat Allen. I don't know why I was saying.
Good. Good morning. Chair Holvey, Chair Wisnett, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Brian Krieg. I'm here representing today the sheet metal and air conditioning contractors, the sheet metal workers, and the Plumbing and Mechanical Contractors Association. Very much in support of this bill. It will be a big help to us. I was one of the drafters about 8 years ago of the bill that created the mechanical board. At that time, we had a structure where all the boards were meeting four times a year. We have found over the years that we do not necessarily need to meet four times a year. And there are also times when we don't need, where it would be more helpful for us to be able to meet a little more frequently, like when we're in a code adoption cycle. So this bill helps with that. It reduces the number, but it doesn't take the power away from us to meet when we need to. We could meet 12 times a year if we needed to under the structure on here. It's a great amendment that was put in at Section 20 in the bill. It will help all the construction boards out there and allow our folks to stay home some days and get some work done instead of coming to Salem. So we urge your support. Thank you.
Thank you. Not seeing any questions for Mr. Krieg. Appreciate it. No one else to testify on Senate Bill 440. Not seeing any, I'll close public hearing on Senate Bill 440 and open a work session on Senate Bill 440.
Mr. Speaker, I have some amendments to that bill. I'd like to
discuss with Todd.
Representative Wisnett.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 440A engrossed to the floor of a due pass recommendation.
Representative Wisnett moves Senate Bill 440 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Not seeing any. Tamara, can we have a vote, please?
Representative Tamara.
Aye.
Representative Clem.
Yes.
Representative Conger.
Aye.
Representative Matthews.
Aye.
Vice Chair Sheehan.
Excused.
Vice Chair Smith.
Aye.
Co-Chair Wisnant.
Aye.
Co-Chair Holby.
Aye. Senate Bill 440 having received the required votes is passed to the floor. And I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 440.
Is there a carrier?
Any volunteers carry this bill?
Oh, somebody else wanted to.
I'll carry the bill. Thank you.
Why'd you ask?
I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 177. If we could call back up our previous panel. Appreciate the interruption, or thank, and see if we can get back on track on Senate Bill 177. So I believe you had finished your testimony, and someone else may want to provide some testimony. Can you introduce yourself for the record, please?
Oh, good morning, Chair Holvey, Chair Wisnant, members of the committee. My name is Scott Burgess. I'm the president and CEO of Rivermark Community Credit Union, based out of Beaverton, Oregon. I also have the privilege of serving as the chair of the State Issues Subcommittee for the Credit Union Association of Oregon this past year. And really, my testimony is going to be fairly brief this morning. I just wanted to talk a little bit about the process that we went through to develop the concepts that are now in this bill. And then I just wanted to make a couple comments on some pieces of the bill that Mr. Scoggins already touched upon. So first of all, I just want to talk about the process. As the chair of the State Issues Subcommittee, previous to the legislature convening in the 12 months prior to, the committee gets together. We bring together about 20 credit union leaders from across the state of Oregon for state chartered credit unions, and we take a look at the Credit Union Act, Oregon Statute 723, and really want to make sure that the Credit Union Act keeps pace with the changing financial landscape, changing needs of our members, changing needs of our organizations. And that's kind of how we ultimately came up with these concepts. We met probably 7-8 times over this past year to talk about what we needed to best serve our members across Oregon, and ultimately vetted this process not only with our committee but also with our association, with credit unions across Oregon, and we also talked to our regulator. At this point, we're not aware of any opposition to the bill. I just wanted to touch on a couple aspects of the bill. Mr. Scoggins already talked about it, but I just want to talk about it maybe from a Rivermark perspective, my credit union. And the first item that I want to touch on is in regards to board meetings, going from the required 12 a year to 10. I think this gives us great flexibility. If we were in the middle of the winter and we had an unforeseen weather circumstance and had to cancel a meeting, we would, under the current law, be out of statute or wouldn't meet the letter of the law. So being able to not have a meeting any particular month and still and meet the statute, I think, is important. But from Rivermark's perspective, if this were to become law, we would not immediately just pencil in 10 board meetings a year and take off a summer month and a holiday month. Our intent would still be to have a monthly board meeting. So, because I think the business typically requires or necessitates that you try to have a board meeting each month. So our intent is going to be that we continue to have 12. I don't know what other credit unions would do, but I think it's important to note that this is the practice of credit unions, and we likely would continue to have our monthly board meetings. But it'd be nice to have that flexibility in the event of unforeseen circumstances. Also wanted to comment on the section regarding loans to officials. Mr. Scoggins gave some good detail on that. And I just want to let the committee know that It's been an administrative headache for credit unions for probably as long as I can remember. I think every session our committee gets together and we talk about this particular provision in our in the Oregon Credit Union Act. And this really looks like a good remedy. And I think it's important to note that that while a loan may not trigger a required approval from the board, it would still be reported to our board. And I think that's an important oversight part of it. And then finally, I just wanted to mention a few comments on the investment powers for investing in CUSOs, credit union service organizations, and Mr. Cole is going to talk a little bit more about this, but I just wanted to mention to you that I think this is a good change to the Act, increasing the authority of credit unions from 2% to 5% is really, I think, responsive of the trends that we're seeing across the financial services industry, and particularly in credit unions across Oregon. We're all trying to find better, more efficient ways to provide products and services to our members. And in looking for those means to do that, we're collaborating more. And the vehicle by which we collaborate is a credit union service organization. So that's a trend we're seeing. I think giving us the added flexibility of increasing our investment in CUSOs will help support efficiency in the industry and help us deliver low-cost products and services to our members. Those are the comments I wanted to make on the bill. I appreciate the opportunity to testify this morning, and thank you very much.
Thank you. If you'd like to give your testimony, please.
Excellent. Co-Chair Solvian, wasn't it? Members of the committee, thank you for hearing us this morning. My name is Kevin Cole. I'm the Chief Financial Officer at MAPS Credit Union. MAPS serves 40,000 members in the Willamette Valley and just celebrated its 75th anniversary. The provisions of this legislation impacting our investment in credit union service organizations are very important to MAPS. We've been very active in this space and would like to make additional investments that we believe are beneficial to our members and to the credit union community, and this legislation would facilitate our ability to do that. Kind of a couple points. You have our written testimony, but this is really an access to capital issue. CUSOs are small businesses and are facing the challenges that the rest of Oregon small businesses are facing. And the primary source of capital for a credit union service organization is its sponsor credit union in the form of an equity investment or a loan. And so without access to adequate capital, our ability to continue to grow those businesses will be challenged. We currently employ 22 full-time employees in our Salem-based credit union service organizations. Many of those companies provide services to Oregon consumers and to other credit unions across the country. We have had a number of opportunities to expand those, and our ability to continue to do that is dependent upon access to capital. As far as a local story on the ground, in 2010, the Wells Fargo Insurance Services shut down their Salem-based operation and terminated their Salem-based staff. We were able to onboard some of those dislocated employees and launch a commercial insurance operation that continues today. And our opportunity to continue local servicing of Oregon-based business is once again dependent on the ability to capitalize those investments. Thank you for your consideration, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions from the committee? Representative Smith.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Could you explain a little more about what are the functions the CUSO can do? Which I understand those are that's the sort of the for-profit arm of a credit union, sort of the nonprofit affiliate. What are the things that a CUSO can do that a credit union can't do, or the credit union couldn't do under a collaborative, not-for-profit institution?
Chair Holby, Chair Wisnant, and Representative Smith, members of the committee, the answer to that, there are a couple of things that a CUSO can do that a credit union couldn't do. And some of it is a matter of efficiency and effectiveness. Some of it is a matter of legal issues. I would first say that I'm not sure that I would necessarily agree with the characterization that it's the for-profit arm of credit unions that are not-for-profit. It is for-profit in the sense that it's not organized as a not-for-profit organization, but its purpose is to provide services to either the credit unions that form it or to the members of the credit unions that form it, in keeping with those credit unions' nonprofit operations. It supports their nonprofit operations. So that's just a preliminary point. In terms of what a CUSO can do that a credit union can't do, some things that a CUSO could do would be to serve members of other credit unions or persons who aren't necessarily a member of the particular credit union that formed it. And again, CUSOs often contract with other credit unions, multiple credit unions, to be able to provide services to their members where the credit unions can't necessarily provide those services. In some cases, that may have to do with separation of functions, for instance, in the area of securities brokerage or insurance. In other cases, it may have to do with licensing issues where employees of the CUSO can become licensed and that licensing is centralized as opposed to having different employees of credit unions who may or may not have to be licensed, but depending on the type of activity. Other things that CUSOs can do that sometimes credit unions can't, more as a matter of probably a technical issue than purely legal issue is for instance, forming a separate entity to provide services to credit unions and keeping the liability out of the credit union, where the credit union's liability for that organization is limited to the amount of its investment. Of course, that's the whole purpose of having a separate entity. And that isolates the risk from the credit union and puts the risk in the CUSO, and especially where you're serving multiple credit unions, you don't necessarily want to have a risk in one credit union from the organization providing services to members of another credit union. And so you can isolate that by having a CUSO. Those are a couple of things.
Follow-ups, yeah, I've got a couple. So here those are a couple of things. And I hear that you don't... My understanding, am I wrong? Are there CUSOs that are not-for-profit? My understanding was it was the for-profit arm. Are there CUSOs that are not-for-profit?
Well, a CUSO that, if it were not-for-profit, then of course it wouldn't have owners, and so technically it wouldn't fit within the definition of a credit union service organization in terms of the statutory arrangement. I mean, it is organized as an Oregon corporation or an Oregon LLC. My point was simply that the purpose is not necessarily to generate profits. It may or it may not generate profits, but the purpose is to support the operations of the credit union or their members.
Got it. Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Follow up.
What services? What services are we talking about? And we're trying to get, like, what's the most important thing or the most important things that a CUSO does that a credit union couldn't do for itself?
Chair Holvey, Chair Wisnant, members of the committee, Representative Smith, the answer to that varies depending on the credit union. Different credit unions form CUSOs for different purposes. We have clients that have formed CUSOs to engage in business lending or to engage in certain types of consumer lending or to do data processing services, to provide insurance insurance either for credit unions or for credit union members that the credit union itself is not in a position to provide. Check processing CUSOs. I'm just trying to check off the list of things that that we've seen CUSOs formed for. And you may want to...
Co-chairs Wisnant and Holvey and Representative Smith. As an example, probably our most unique venture that we offer is a wireless technology provider that provides a text banking product that's now available in over 500 credit unions. It's launched right here from Salem, Oregon, developed by MAPS employees, and it is a type of investment or type of company that we just felt it was appropriate to put it in a segregated entity because of the type of work that it was doing. We also have two insurance agencies that we own that we would not be able to offer the types of insurance that those agencies offer through the credit union.
So business lending, consumer lending, insurance, check processing, text banking, are all of those things that a credit union is prohibited to do under its nonprofit model? So but I'm trying to put it sort of through my addled dumb kid's brain, right? So the one way of me thinking about it is a CUSO is the thing that allows a credit union to do things that are more like what a bank does and do it within the law, which is good and appropriate. Are any of those items things that a credit union can do without a CUSO? Or, like, I don't know credit union law well enough to know if they're prohibited from doing business lending, consumer lending, providing insurance, check processing, and text banking under their current form.
Chair Holvey, Chair Wisnant, Representative Smith, members of the committee, the answer to that question is all of those things actually that were just listed, credit unions in Oregon could engage in to some extent or another, but what they can't do necessarily is in an effective way collaborate with other credit unions or take advantage of the economies of scale that can be realized by serving a number of different credit unions or a number of their members. And I would add mortgage lending to that list. That's another activity that we have a number of credit unions. And again, credit unions can do mortgage lending themselves, but because of some of the costs and various other requirements involved and the relationships that need to be formed, in a lot of cases it can be much more effectively managed when you have a separate organization that's serving a number of different credit unions or serving a number of their members. Data processing would be something that a credit union could do for itself. You can make the argument that it might be able to do that for other credit unions as well, but it could only be in a very limited capacity. You know, a credit union could build a data processing system that can serve its own functions, and it can only provide those services to other credit unions to the extent that it has, quote, excess capacity. But if you form a data processing CUSO, then you don't have that same limitation, and you can realize the economies of scale that can be accrued from serving a whole bunch of different credit unions all at once. And again, the limitation of liability in those instances is very important to the credit unions.
Chair Holvey, Chair Wisnett, Representative Smith, Pam Levitt, Credit Union Association. I want you to not think of CUSOs as something we're doing to be bank-like. Credit unions need all of these products and services. We need check processing. But the credit union movement is very unique. We find ways to collaborate. When we have an ATM network, instead of, you know, each bank has their own ATM network, credit unions come together under our co-op network and collaborate. When we need check processing, we come together and we collaborate. That's the credit union movement, and that's why these CUSOs, these products and services that you're hearing about, it's not that we're trying to be bank-like. It's that we're trying to serve our members with the necessary products and services, whether it's insurance or data processing or check processing, and doing it uniquely. If we didn't have a check processor that was a credit union product, we'd be going to bank organizations. And so we always, in my, you know, 18 years, we've always looked for ways to collaborate together first if we can. And that's where a lot of the CUSO products and services have begun.
If I could just follow up on that, one that is in the process of being formed right now is a CUSO to perform compliance services for member credit unions. Credit unions, like banks and like others in the financial services marketplace right now, have been hit with an incredible, I mean, just a staggering compliance burden over the past couple of years. And it costs just huge amounts of money. And where credit unions can collaborate and form a compliance CUSO, which, again, there would be all kinds of difficulties in one credit union providing compliance services for another credit union, or they can come together, form a separate organization that serves each of those entities, then they can get the services more cheaply. They can control what's happening with the provider of the services, but they don't have some of the liability or other technical employment and all kinds of other issues that come out of one credit union trying to provide the services for a whole group of credit unions.
So,
Are there statutory limits on what CUSOs can invest in, or what they can do with the monies that credit unions loan to CUSOs?
Chair Holby, Chair Wisnant, members of the committee, there are limits on what the CUSOs can do, and it's essentially based on the statutory purpose of the CUSO, and the CUSO is organized for the purpose of serving credit unions or serving their members and performing functions that a credit union could perform. So if a CUSO steps outside of those permissible functions, then the regulator's response to that would be to say, credit union, you have to divest yourself of your investment in that CUSO if it's performing impermissible functions.
Can they make loans?
Can
CUSOs?
Chair Holby, members of the committee, they can make loans.
Business loans as well?
They can make business loans. We do have CUSOs that are making business loans, yes.
No questions, Mr.
Chair.
Senator Smith.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. The, Pam, thank you. And the and I think, you know, making it so that credit unions can compete and can do stuff and operate is hugely important, and appreciate your efforts in that. When we're talking about 2% to 5%, doesn't sound like big numbers, but I don't know what I'm, you know, I don't know what I'm talking about. What are we... from the range, I know you got 83 different members, so I'm sure it's a big range, but ballpark range, what are we talking about for a given credit union to be able to invest in a CUSO from the 1 plus 1 to the 2? You know, what kind of shift in aggregate dollars are we talking about? Just to understand the magnitude, ballpark.
Chair Holby, Chair with the members of the committee, Representative Smith, that really varies depending on the nature of what the CUSO does and on who and how many credit unions are involved in it. We have a CUSO that was recently formed, which is probably more the exception than the rule, that that took in an $11 million investment, although that was from a number of different sources, not just from one credit union. We have others that are much more along the lines of $50,000, $100,000 a pop. Maybe you have 10 credit unions contributing $100,000 to a CUSO that's forming to do data processing services, and they might need to contribute more as time goes on. A compliance CUSO would be less, depending, again, on the number of credit unions involved, but obviously there's less upfront investment in something like that. It really depends on the size of the credit union, the services to be provided, and we've seen initial investments all the way from as little as, you know, $10,000, $25,000, $50,000.
That's different from my question. What I mean is not how big might a CUSO be, although that's interesting too. But if I'm, is the 2% to 5% limit, does that mean that I'm a credit union and I, for all CUSOs that I invest in total on my balance sheet or whatever, it can't be any more than 2 or 5%? Or does it mean any given CUSO? My impression is it's aggregate.
Chair Holby, Chair Wisnant, Representative Smith, you're correct.
Right.
I'm sorry for misunderstanding.
No, that's okay. So if I'm a credit union, what's that limit mean to me from 2% to 5%?
So if you're a $100 million credit union and your limit currently then is $2 million, the limit would go up to $5 million in terms of your aggregate ability to invest. And for some credit unions, that may not make any difference, but there are a number of credit unions that may make a difference. They may not want to go up to five, but they may need another million.
And this, Mr. Chair, is my last question, I think. I apologize.
Go ahead.
How a credit union customer, how do I interact with a CUSO? Do I come in and it's like, it's still Rivermark, and I see, oh, it's Rivermark, and I go there? Or is it a somewhat different institution, and it has a different brand, and several credit unions, you know, it's not Teachers Credit Union anymore, it's On Point, Rivermark, and a few others kind of buy in, and then I go to River Point or, you know, Teachers Bank. What does it look like?
Chair Holvey, Representative Smith, most credit unions want the membership to have the relationship with the credit union. So I think most credit unions would say that the products and services they're offering, it may be through a CUSO, they'd want it to be seamless to the membership. Although, you know, I remember, you know, First Tech had their, investment arm, you know, within their operation, and other credit unions will welcome, you know, other CUSO products under their name. But I think most credit unions, and Scott, you might want to mention this, want it to be seamless to the members, and it will be a product that's offered by the credit union.
Thanks.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Pam, I don't know about you or Mr. Cole, but I think it'd be helpful to put on the record your last page of the testimony you provided about the taxation, you know, concerning the legislatures on taxation of the CUSOs. You
oh.
Summarize that last, next to last paragraph. Or
sure.
I'm not asking for it's just I think it's good to put it on the record. I think you summarized it well there.
Very good. Chair Wisnett, Chair Holvey, members of the committee, in response to the tax question, our LLCs that are owned by the credit union and operate as CUSOs enjoy the credit union's pass-through of the credit union's tax-exempt status only to the extent that the activity in which they are engaged is tax-exempt as well. And other items will be subject under UBIT, as I understand it, to tax if they are not related to the credit union's tax-exempt purpose.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, can we clarify what that means? An LLC, so an LLC sends out a K-1 on a, does MAPS get the K-1 on the insurance business for their share, and they're going to be paying taxes on that? Is that what you're saying?
Chair Holvey, Chair Wisnett, Representative Cameron, we do receive a K-1 from our ownership interest in the different LLCs. The determination, it's the LLCs, not the responsible party, to determine whether that is taxable. That is falls on the owner of the LLC interest. In that case, it would be MAPS Credit Union. And in the particular case of insurance, that's considered a activity that is related to our tax-exempt purpose of promoting thrift and protecting financial assets and is not currently subject to the income tax.
Follow up for me?
Follow up.
What activity would be considered taxable that you're participating in?
Chair Holvey, Chair Wisnett, Representative Cameron, it's not exactly codified in a number of IRS rulings at this point. There are a number of cases that are involving the UBIT as it relates to state-chartered credit unions. There have been some preliminary rulings as to things that aren't subject to UBIT. As an example of things that are, whether they're in a credit union or a CUSO, when we charge a non-member a fee to use one of our ATMs, that is a non-tax exempt source of revenue, and we're required to pay income taxes on the net income generated from that activity. There was some question about products like a credit life and disability insurance that ultimately were decided in favor of credit unions, that they were related to our primary purpose of promoting thrift and protecting financial assets. And there are still a number of items that have not worked their way through the entire IRS determination process. Certain types of debit and credit card interchange are currently subject of ongoing legal discussion at this point.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Conger.
So I think you may have addressed this in response to one of Representative Smith's questions, but if you did, I missed the answer. So this Section 4 of the bill deals with this with the CUSO issue, but also makes some other changes that look to me like mostly just grammatical to what credit unions can invest in. And so the question I have, there's two parts that are being increased from 2% of assets to 5% of assets, and I think they're in paragraph 7 and in paragraph 5. My impression is that both of those subsections deal with what you're calling CUSOs. In the language of the bill, it's corporation, limited liability company, or mutual association in subsection 5, and then in subsection 7, it's national or state credit union association, which I guess would be an investment in another credit union, not a CUSO. But then it says, or corporation. So, two-part question, and then I think I'm done. One is, are those two paragraphs dealing with the same thing? And the second question is, should we be concerned about a risk of concentration of investments or assets in credit unions? You know, could you conceivably have a, through those two paragraphs, have a direct or indirect 10% of a credit union's assets concentrated in a CUSO? Does that create any concerns in terms of portfolio risk and things like that? Does that make sense?
Chair Holby, members of the committee, Representative Conger, that does make sense, and recognizing that the language is a bit imprecise, I can tell you that that's not what the original intent of the statute as it was drafted, and I think even with these amendments, that's still not the intent, which is not obvious just from reading it. I think the intent is that paragraph 7 there covers associations like Credit Union National Association, the Northwest Credit Union Association, and other sort of trade groups like that, which would be different from the CUSOs. And I don't believe that the DCBS would allow any credit union to go over a 5% concentration in CUSO investments based on this statute, and that's certainly not what was intended by the group as the drafting process went through. That sort of dual investment has always been there in the statute, and it's never been terribly clear, and but that is what the intent is.
Just a quick follow-up. Can you just briefly explain then what the different purposes would be? I mean, I understand trade group or association. I don't understand why a member would make loans to a trade group, and I'm sure there's a simple answer to that, but normally I envision the members of a trade group paying membership dues, and so under what circumstances would the assets of a credit union loaned to its trade group ever hit 2%, let alone 5%, 2% in the existing statute, 5% in the bill? But maybe just clarify what the difference between a CUSO and the association is.
Thank you, Chair Holby, members of the committee, Representative Conger. I'm not sure that it ever would, frankly, hit those levels, and I don't think this was a particularly big issue that anyone here focused on. And the times where a credit union might make a loan to either the state trade association or the national trade association or some other type of trade association would be pretty limited. And to answer the other part of your question, the difference would be a CUSO is an organization formed by one or more credit unions to perform specific services for those credit unions, and it's organized as a corporation or an LLC under the applicable state law. The association that we're talking about here would be a trade association, which I suppose in some cases is organized as a corporation. In other cases, might be organized as an association, but it really is organized to perform trade association type services, whether it is government relations or advisory and other sort of group-type services that are not specific to individual credit unions, like those of a CUSO would be. And the circumstances where credit unions might make a loan to an association might be where the association is undertaking a specific new activity and for some reason needs to raise capital or needs to raise funds and anticipates being able to replenish those funds from ongoing operations. And, you know, I can't even, honestly, as I sit here, think of a good example of when that's happened in any time recent. It's just that it's always been in the statute.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony, and I think that we'll probably continue this conversation a little bit more. It seems there's a lot of questions, and people still need a little more time learning about CUSOs in particular, and a little bit more about this bill. So with that, I appreciate your testimony today. Appreciate the conversation. Very helpful for us. And so I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 177 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 908. Jean, could you give us a brief little description of Senate Bill 908?
Yes, Mr. Chair and members. The bill changes the title of the Director of Affirmative Action to the Director of Diversity and Inclusion. Changes the title of Advocate for Minority Women and Emerging Small Business to the Director of Economic and Business Equity. Transfers duties of maintaining the Oregon Opportunity Register and Clearinghouse from the Office of Minority Women and Emerging Small Business to the Director of Economic and Business Equity. Declares an emergency effective on passage. There's no amendment, there's no fiscal impact, and there's no revenue impact.
Thank you. And before us, we have Frank Garcia, I think, and Cheryl Myers. Welcome. If you'd identify yourself for the record, please.
Yes, welcome. Good morning. For the record, my name is Frank Garcia. I am with the Office of the Governor, currently Director of Affirmative Action. Representative Holvey, Representative Winston, it's an honor to be here to just talk a little bit about the support of this bill change. Diversity and inclusion is basically 21st century language and discipline based on affirmative action, suffrage, civil rights, access, and equity. It's contemporary terminology. It's more relevant than affirmative action. Society, whether in private or in business, is doing things to improve their organization, whether it's selling the widget or service delivery. It's based on organizational development, problem solving, innovation, creativity, leadership in this global multicultural marketplace. So what's happening in society today is really not so much about enforcement as much as it is engagement. People recognize the demographic shifts that are happening, including here in Oregon, which is now 28% people of color, the buying power associated with that. And for organizations and businesses to thrive, they want to incorporate all Oregonians, all residents, all citizens to be part of that process so that they can prosper. Diversity and inclusion is based on, again, the spirit of civil rights, suffrage, affirmative action. It's just born out of this. And so it's not so much the enforcement these days. We will still do that. We will still monitor. We will enforce. But it's really about compelling and engaging folks to have your organization thrive. This is the language that has come out of Society for Human Resource Management, which is the leader on workforce diversity, workplace diversity. I think it just makes us more relevant as we move forward into the 21st century marketplace.
Good morning, Cheryl Myers, also from the Governor's Office, Chairs Holvey and Wisnett, and members of the committee. It is a pleasure to be in front of you today in support of Senate Bill 908. And my part of this is that it does change the name from Advocate for Minority Women and Emerging Small Business to Director of Economic and Business Equity, and it is merely a name change to reflect the 21st century.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Questions? I do have one question myself. I appreciate the bill, the intent of the bill. I think it's great. I noticed there's one thing in the bill that I wanted to ask about because it seems like one of the most important pieces of the bill where you're maintaining an Oregon Opportunity Register and Clearinghouse for information.
Yes.
As I've researched the bill asking my committee administrator, there is no fiscal on this bill, so I would guess that particular duty is something that's already being done with staff in a different form, and it's just
that is
clarifying
correct.
This.
That is correct. That has been in effect for a long time.
Okay.
And so it just clarifies where that office and direction, where that role lives.
Great, great. Thank you. It looks, anyway, that one caught my eye as being a real proactive activity, actually, as opposed to just a name change.
Exactly.
So appreciate that. Any other questions? Representative Sheehan.
Thank you, Chair Holvey. It's good to see you here at the Capitol, Cheryl, on that side of the desk.
Tough.
I'm not sure everyone would agree with that.
Your bill's all under code. So I do have some questions regarding just clarity and transparency of all of this. So the affirmative action piece, the affirmative action program itself is still called affirmative action. It's not going away.
Right.
In the statute, it just mentions only affirmative action. It's a fairly brief statute, saying the primary duty of the occupant of this position shall be to direct and monitor affirmative action programs in all state agencies. And there's really nothing else in there. Would it be more appropriate to change that and the duties of, I mean, even the header for the statute says affirmative action, and your testimony has the diversity inclusion of Title VI of non-discrimination federally assisted programs. It seems like it's very clear when you say that you're the director of affirmative action that you administer that program, where this seems more ambiguous. Would this cause difficulty in someone understanding what program that they were looking for to participate in?
Chair Holdy, Chair Winsett, Representative Sheehan, I don't think so at this point. I think it's just, you know, part of the process of developing this discipline as it matures. I think too much prescription at this point I don't think would bring any clarity to it. I think just the title with the name change is significant enough, and it'll bring people up to speed in regards to what we're doing. And none of it's changing in regards to the monitoring and managing of compliance. We're just trying to move forward with language again that is more reflective and creates a positive response within organizations in improving service delivery and being more effective. So I don't think so.
Okay. And another question, Mr. Chair?
Follow up.
And the same thing on the other side is as we're looking through this, because we had the benefit of an hour of debate with the last one. I had a chance to read through this pretty carefully. It refers over and over and over again to minority women and emerging small businesses, and again with the ambiguity of the title. Are you concerned in this agency that if I'm a female business owner and I own like a fishing fleet or something like that, and I was looking for a government contract of some sort, and I was skimming through looking for that, and I saw the Director of Economic and Business Equity, would that give me the clarity to understand that I was in the right place?
I don't believe so, and I think really the clarifying piece is we've been using these working titles for a little bit, but the first month that I was here, I got calls from a parent in Montana wanting me to advocate for her daughter to receive her child support payments, and I redirected her to the Attorney General's office. I got a call from someone wanting me to advocate for a commutation of a sentence. So that advocate piece, you know, sounds like, you know, is, you know, what is it you do? It was actually more confusing for the public than finding, you know, that word economic and equity together. Mm-hmm. And so if you go search for, really, the only people that understand that acronym, MWESB, are people that are wonky and work in that world. So we're still using that acronym at the end of the title. So on my business cards, it says Director of Economic and Business Equity, MWESB. And so it's really clear, I think, when you put in searching for minority or women or emerging small business, it comes directly to my website.
Would it be wiser to just change that from advocate to director? Or if advocacy is the issue, I'm just concerned that we're changing it to economic and business equity when we're taking away those three key words that someone would be looking for.
Certainly, and I would just anecdotally say one of the most interesting comments from my predecessor was that she would always introduce herself as the advocate for minority, women, an emerging small business. And because it's such a long title, sometimes people are left thinking that you have to be all of those as an entity versus each of those, which is separate, and that she had to explain one time to a woman after a conference exactly how could she become a common woman business, because she had put the comma in there and she heard common. So it is a long title. And it does not necessarily, it's the work of what I do, but it's not the title necessarily of what I do.
Okay, thank you. Just for clarity on that particular point that Representative Sheehan is bringing up, there still, I believe, still exists, even after this bill, if it were to pass, passes, inside the Oregon Business Development Department, an office for minority women and emerging small business.
That's correct, so, and that's the certification office.
And so that, it's not that
still
it
there.
Has gone away. It's
right.
Still there. It's just that we're clarifying that the director of economic and business equity actually performs or is responsible for all these
for the
duties.
Oversight.
Yeah,
sure.
Thank you.
Sure. Representative Smith, thanks for sharing. Yeah, I would just say, I mean, I know, you know, Vicky Nakashima, who used to be at DAS and has served in various roles, this bill, which I really support, came out of some discussions exactly related to your concerns, right? It was like, wait a minute, I'm not a minority women business. No, you don't have to be, right? And this phrase is hopefully going to be a step forward.
Thank you. Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Garcia, the deletion or change from affirmative action, diversity, and inclusion, is that reflected in federal legislation or federal policy too? Or is the federal government doing the same thing with their affirmative action term?
Representative Holvey, Representative Wisnett, there are examples of that happening. And so at the state, local, and county level, I could find those for you and provide a list to you at your if that's what you're requesting. But, yeah, there are examples out there, not only in government, but, again, in private sector as well.
My background is the federal government, so I'm saying is that also happening in the federal government level?
Yeah, I believe so.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Conger.
I just want to weigh in on the, I think along the same lines of the prior questions and say that,
okay.
To me, first of all, I understand the maybe how there was some confusion with the title, minority, women and emerging small business. I can understand why that might need to be tweaked. I'm not sure I think, Director of Economic and Business Equity is any clearer. I mean, I don't know what economic equity means. I think it seems to me that with this position, it would be fairly important to make sure that people could find you and, would be able to understand that what your role is. So I don't think that the title accomplishes that. And I also think the same thing about changing the title of Director of Affirmative Action, which seems to me to be very clear, because I think everyone understands what affirmative action means, or almost everyone, whereas Director of Diversity and Inclusion might not be as clear, frankly. And, maybe it's more perspective in terms of where you want to take it, where you want the meaning to go. But it may not be clear to people what that is right now. I also noticed that in the statute, and again, I think this was said already, but, Director of Diversity and Inclusion, primary duty of the occupant of this position shall be to direct and monitor affirmative action programs, not diversity and inclusion programs. So I'm not, and please feel free to respond. It's not a question. I just think that this is not, words matter, and this may not be actually a very useful set of changes that we're advocating here. Maybe not the most useful is what the way I should put it.
I'd like to respond. Representative Holvey, Representative Wisnett, Representative Conger. Affirmative action came out of suffrage and civil rights, as I stated earlier, and it had to start somewhere. And it came out of case law, but it started with an injustices. And a case law came in and created an opportunity for us to implement affirmative action programs. Diversity and inclusion is built on
we're at a new point in time in this 21st century marketplace where it's matured and it's based on that foundation. There was some education that had to go with affirmative action in its onset. There is going to be education that needs to go with diversity and inclusion as society begins to understand the global marketplace and this marketplace and how we're all going to thrive and prosper. There is going to be that lag, that gap, that education that's going to be required. What we're signaling here is that we're ready. Society is ready. Government is ready. Many businesses, private sector government is ready for this. It's a mature enough discipline now in the profession that it can elevate to this level and be changed so that we can begin to set forth and help Oregon thrive and prosper. And so there's some education that needs to take place, and it's that's going to be the charge over the next few years, so that we can get people on board completely. But I think it's an opportune time with what we're facing today in our current state of the economy and moving forward in this 21st century marketplace.
Chair Wisnett, I would like to respond, and Representative Conger, I also concur that words do matter. And in working in this world, I believe that these words do matter and that they are clarifying to the constituencies that we serve. I look around our larger agencies, and you'll note that we don't have numerous positions created for equity work, not for affirmative action work. And so that streams more succinctly throughout both the public and private sector than titles that were created many, many years ago. And I think it is more reflective of our current state.
Thank you. Other questions, committee members? Other questions? Any other testimony on this bill? Thank you very much. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 908.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Could I ask the committee's intent here? Do you still have questions or suggestions?
My only comment would be that, these are folks that I'm sure have thought this out with best intentions. They're representing the governor's office. They've gone through the Senate process. I don't discount the concerns that we're raising, but you look at the way that we run our offices alone. Some of us have one person working, and we call them the chief of staff. Others call them legislative aide. I don't think there's a whole lot of confusion on the outside of what that means. I think it's what we desire, and I perhaps think that the best people to judge us would be the folks that are engaged in the position and engaged in that activity. So I'm supportive, and I'm ready to move this forward. I think we should get it done today.
That's the committee there in intent or comments on whether to move.
Representative Smith.
Yeah, so I'd say, this is something that comes not only from the folks who testified and from the governor's office, but also from the community. In the interim, we had some discussion about this, and this is the direction the private sector is moving into. In fact, lots of companies are now having VPs of, and they're not having VPs of affirmative action. They're VPs of diversity and inclusion, chief officers, chief diversity officers. Hello, Derek. I think this reflects what the private sector is doing, and I think this comes from the community. And in fact, we had in the recruiting for these positions, some of the highest qualified people were like, "Hey, wait a minute, why isn't this up to date? Why isn't this reflective of what's happening in the community?" So I think this would be a positive move for the state. I respect the good comments that have been made, and to the extent we have the will to move the bill, I would certainly support that.
That's fine. Any other discussion?
No.
I appreciate you bringing the bill forward. I am supportive of the bill and see that affirmative action is just a piece of the whole structure of what this office would be doing under the Director of Diversity and Inclusion. I think it's a good bill. But at this point, I think we're just going to close the public hearing.
He closed the public hearing.
Right? You closed the public hearing, and
we're in limbo.
You're having a discussion outside of public hearing and not in a work session. Oh, yeah, that's interesting.
Ramona didn't come down.
Oh, she probably will be down any second. So I guess I'm not closing anything. And
you want to do work session? Work session.
I will open a work session on House Bill 530. Jan, can you remind us what Senate Bill 530 is?
It's the bill that changes the name of the Commission on Asian Affairs to the Commission on Asian and Pacific Islander Affairs, clarifies some duties of the Commission, and the committee has before it the -1 amendment. That amendment was not adopted at the last meeting, and it was taking out trade opportunities from the list of information that the Commission would compile data on. There's no revenue impact on the bill. There's a minimal fiscal impact.
Thank you. We have an amendment before us.
This one here?
Yep. No.
Last page. Flip over. Okay, Mr. Chair, I move -1 amendments dated April 5, 2011 to Senate Bill 530.
Representative Wisnant moves -1 amendments dated April 5th, 2011 to Senate Bill 530. Discussion? Representative Clem, I know that you had a lot of questions about this amendment, and my understanding you've come to a position or have some information you'd like to share with us, or maybe not.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I did a little talking with one member of the commission who I know pretty well, and she is watching right now. Hello, darling. I'm fine with the compiling of information. I think just in background, at one point apparently the commission signed a memorandum of understanding with the government of the Philippines without talking to anybody at all in Business Oregon or the governor's office a long time ago. So then they had their selves, the former members and things got told, hey, don't go around doing trade deals with the Philippines or other people without somebody from the state being involved. I think that was the nexus of where the trade opportunity thing, they sort of got neutered from being allowed to be involved in that because people felt they shouldn't be out cutting trade deals with other countries or memorandums of understanding or whatever it was. So I think now the renewed interest in having them be able to participate and take advantage of their, if they have any, like I said the other day, not everybody on there has a bunch of, you know, pocket trade deals going at any moment, but if they do, having them, you know, make those available to people to pursue, I think is a good thing. I'm sure that given what happened before, they're not likely to go start signing treaties again or anything, but that was apparently what happened. So I'm pleased to have them back in the trade and economic development compilation business, and I think barrier identification business. Fine with me. I'd like my wife to retire eventually from this volunteer gig that's been going on for 10 years, and so maybe this will help me get her off of there as well. Thank you very little.
Thank you very little.
We have a motion to adopt the -1 amendments. Any objection to the -1 amendments? Seeing none, -1 amendments are adopted. Representative Wisnant. Well, we cannot move the bill. We are waiting for fiscal.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to come down here, you know.
So with that, I will close the work session on Senate Bill 530. And let's open a work session on Senate Bill 556. I think so.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 556 and gross to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Senate Bill 556 amended and grossed.
Thank you.
Representative Wisnett moves Senate Bill 556 as amended. Do we have an amendment on that?
No, so it's an
no.
A. It's an A. 556
A. Representative Wisnett moves Senate Bill 556 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I'd like to have Mr. Krieg come forward.
King.
My memory. I shouldn't rely on my memory.
Harvey.
Good morning. I just wanted to probably follow up with a few questions. I know that we asked some questions and one of them was about your policy on what, how do you define what's available and what's not available. Could you comment on that real quick?
Chair Holy, Chair Wisnett, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brian King, the Department of Administrative Services Fleet Manager, and I did provide a little bit for the record. DAS doesn't create policies until there's legislation to support them. However, I provided some preliminary language about what our take is on what that would mean. And for available, it would be that a car at the employee's work site is not in use, so that they could use it. The other piece is for Salem-Keizer area, they would have the opportunity to use our tools to see if an alternative rental vehicle was available or not. So that would define where available is. The other question was about authorized. And for authorized, our initial take on that would be if somebody has a medical accommodation that requires special, their car is suited to their particular back problem or something like that, that would be an authorized piece. Or the agency would have to provide some kind of documentation that they did a cost-benefit analysis that this was the most cost-effective means for transportation for that individual to receive the higher rate.
Thank you. Were there other committee members that had outstanding questions or information that they wanted to bring up at this point?
Oh, appreciate the document.
Seeing any. I appreciate the answers and looking towards the future, I guess, of how the agency would define available. I think it is an important question that we are interested in. And realize that you have the ability to make rules around that as well, I believe. Hopefully you do. So with that, thank you very much. We have a motion on the table and no other discussion. Tamara, could you give us a roll call vote?
Representative Cameron.
Excused.
Representative
Yes.
Representative Conger.
Aye.
Representative
Matthews. Aye. Vice Chair Sheehan. Yes. Vice Chair Smith. Aye. Co-Chair Wisnett. Aye. Co-Chair Olien. Aye. Senate Bill 556, having received required votes, is passed to the floor. Volunteer for a carrier. Thank you, Representative Smith. With that, I'll close work session on Senate Bill 556. We did not get to Senate Bill 53, and we'll carry that bill over till Thursday. And with that, we are probably going to reschedule Senate Bill 177 instead of carrying it over. I think there's a little bit of discussion that needs to happen with that. And anything else we need to carry over? Yes, we'll carry over Senate Bill 908 as well. With that, I'll adjourn the House Committee on General Government and Consumer Protection for May 3rd.